This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up next hour, it's our first installment of a new segment called Teach Me What You Know. This week, an entrepreneur will teach us how to start a business.
First, a look at a business that's behind much of the modern American diet, the meat industry.
Americans seem to have an insatiable appetite for meat, which stands at the center of most of our daily meals. But how did we get this way? A historian will join us to explain.
And we want to hear from you. Do you wonder where your meat comes from? Do you care about how the animal was raised, or do you simply want it to be cheap? Call in at 800-642-1234. And is meat a part of every dinner for you? Does it have to be there? Call us and tell us about it. It's 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Maureen Ogle joins us now. She's a historian and author of In Meat We Trust, an unexpected history of carnivore America. Maureen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, many of our modern American meals are centered around meat as a main course. How did we get to become such a meat-loving culture?
We can trace it all the way back to those founding mothers and fathers during the colonial period. When European settlers came to the eastern seaboard of North America, they were coming from what we usually call the Old World, which for them was a world where food and land were both chronically scarce. But when they came to North America, they found what seemed to them to be an infinite amount of land, and they very quickly imposed on that land their definition of civilization, which included livestock husbandry and domesticated animals. And long before the American Revolution broke out in the late 18th century, the colonists in the British colonies in North America were widely known as being vociferous carnivores and were eating meat on a scale that visitors to the colonies found hard to believe, because even the poorest people were eating meat all the time on a regular basis.
Was that something that is different then from the land in which they came from? Was this a relatively new way of eating?
In where they had come from, certainly meat was prized and valued. But they had come from very land-scarce areas and also parts of the world where there was a very well-defined social hierarchy, social and political hierarchy. And those two things combined meant that average people rarely had enough to eat, let alone as much meat as they wanted. And so that's what changed when they came here. They were able to create a new meat-eating culture.
And you write that it was also a symbol of wealth, too, that they brought with them.
Yes. Well, it became real wealth for them. One of the things that colonists suffered from, well, and then after the Revolution, Americans as well, until the late 19th century, was a labor shortage. And livestock were, because there was so much land, people could simply let their stock graze freely, and it was quite easy for anyone to have, say, at least a steer, perhaps a couple of hogs, maybe a few sheep. And as a result, many people very quickly accumulated wealth in the form of livestock, which they could trade, or, of course, they could eat, but they could also trade. If it was a cow, for example, they could sell meat and cheese. So livestock also very quickly became a form of actual wealth to the people who lived in the colonies, of a sort that they would not have been able to enjoy access to in the Old World.
And are we talking about every household having livestock, or was it just, what percentage of the population had their own livestock?
Probably about 100, because at the time, of course, cities were not, at least not yet. They soon would be, and the cities would have a tremendous impact on how Americans thought about meat and how they made it. But during the colonial period, the small towns that served as ports through which goods were shipped back to the Old World and some goods into the New World were few and far between. And so virtually every household, regardless of where they lived and regardless of status, would have had some kind of livestock that they owned and they kept on their living space.
Well, and that certainly changed over time, as we know. Talk a little bit about when the act of raising and slaughtering and butchering our own animals and consuming meat became two distinct and very separate things.
After the American Revolution ended, Americans very quickly began to move off the eastern seaboard down into the Ohio River Valley first, because there was a river and there were no roads, so that's how people traveled. But what Americans also began to do, rather to the surprise of many observers, was that they very quickly demonstrated a preference for living in town rather than on a farm, and that went hand in hand with Americans' efforts to construct their own independent economy, which meant they needed a manufacturing base. And manufacturing, by default, in a sense, created communities, so that cities began to grow very quickly. By the 1860s, when the Civil War broke out, already 25% of Americans, on average, were living in a city, and along the eastern seaboard, that percentage was much, much higher. As that happened, Americans made the great shift that altered the way their relationship with livestock production in particular, because city folks don't make their own food. That's something that's so obvious we tend to forget it. City people don't supply their own food. They can have backyard gardens, maybe there are urban gardens, but in general, city people rely on farmers. And so as urban populations grew, more and more people were living in circumstances in which they had no connection to, no immediate access to livestock, and certainly no connection to how food was raised.
Did that have any significant impact on the amount of meat that was eaten?
No. No, it did not. Americans very, very quickly developed a remarkably sophisticated system for raising livestock in rural parts of the country, and using railroads in particular, after the 1850s, using railroads. Before that, they herded livestock overland. For moving livestock into the great cities, which again were mostly at that time concentrated on the eastern seaboard, where those animals were slaughtered and processed and then distributed to butchers, who then sold them to consumers.
Well, and family farms were, and still are, around, but maybe not in as great a prominence as they were historically. When did family farms begin to make way for large agribusiness?
Oh, how much time do we have? That's the great myth. I should stress here that I am a historian, and that was my only interest in writing this book. I knew absolutely nothing about any of it when I started, and I spent 7 years researching and writing the book. And I was surprised to discover that the claim that family farmers have been driven out by agribusiness and big corporations is just simply not true. The more accurate statement would be that family farmers have struggled since really the early 19th century to try to figure out how to feed this urban population that was outnumbering itself. Farmers have been a minority in this country for a very long time, and certainly throughout the entire 20th century, they've been a small minority. And the things that, like concentrated animal feeding operations, for example, the use of antibiotics and so forth, those kinds of things were not the products of big corporations who were trying to drive family farmers out. They were tools that were adopted and embraced by family farmers in the 20th century as they tried to figure out how to have a profitable farming operation that would feed the demands of a large urban population.
And so what we see then is just an evolution of that?
Yes. As before World War II in particular, Americans and farmers and city folks alike decided that really farming just had to be modernized, because farmers simply weren't keeping up with demand. And not just in the United States. Americans have been shipping their agricultural products abroad, and global demand kept increasing as well. During World War II, there was tremendous pressure on farmers at a time when they had extraordinary labor shortages. I was genuinely surprised by that. There was tremendous pressure on farmers to embrace things like mechanization and automation to replace labor, which in turn made farms more and more like factories. Farms also got much bigger, because farmers who simply didn't want to have a farm like that couldn't stay in business. So family farms became larger and larger operations. And in the 1970s, during a very complicated global economic situation that involved what was at the time regarded as a global famine, Many corporations did decide, much as I should say people are thinking today, that, boy, there's going to be global pressure for food. Agriculture will be a great investment. One of the quotes in the book that I used is that at the time, analysts were regarding agriculture as the new IBM, meaning it was a great place to invest. And many family farmers incorporated and increased their size again. Many of them decided to sell to corporations that came along with offers of money because corporations thought that they could make big money on it. But the other driving factor was that consumer demand became increasingly fragmented and specialized, and grocery chains, this is the thing that surprised me. Grocery chains have an incredible amount of power dictating terms to meat packers and farmers alike. This is what consumers want. This is what we're going to buy, and we're not going to buy anything else. So give us these kinds of hogs, give us these kinds of cattle. And big farmers and then eventually corporate farmers were the ones that organized themselves to satisfy that demand.
Well, we'll pick up with that just after the break. We're talking with Maureen Ogle, historian and author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history, the past or present of the meat industry in the United States? Maybe you work in that industry. Are you a farmer with cattle, pigs? Are you a butcher? Do you work at a grocery chain dealing with meat? Call in and tell us your story at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We're talking with Maureen Ogle. She is a historian and author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America.
And we hope you'll join the conversation. Are you a vegetarian? Why did you become one? Or have you made the choice to not be a vegetarian? Why or why not? Or did you think about it at all? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Maureen, we have been talking about how our demand for meat has changed over time and how it's become a little bit more specialized, too. What do you think accounts for that, our evolution in our taste for meat?
I think, again, it was that very early colonial abundance. Americans, during the colonial period, it's clear from literary evidence and archaeological evidence that Americans who ate meat were eating whole animals. They ate organs, tongue, brain, so on and so forth. But in the 19th century, as supplies of meat increased and as more and more people moved to cities, what changed was the cuts of meat that Americans demanded. They refused to eat organs, tongue was off the table, brains and so forth, and started wanting only what we would think of them as normal cuts. Steak, roast, and so on and so forth. Those became the cuts of choice, which made it difficult for meat packers because it meant that they had a great deal of the carcass that they weren't selling. So consumer demand has led to sort of higher-end taste palates and also put even greater pressure on the people who supply the meat, the livestock, and the meat itself.
Well, we have been hearing from some people who are actually preparing meat while they listen to the program. Jim in Montello says he's listening to the show while butchering venison because it's a tradition this time of year in Wisconsin. It's very true. We also have Danny in Green Bay on the line. Hi, Danny.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to put a little perspective on how much actually is done per day. I work at a meatpacking plant in Green Bay, and we do about 2,200 head of cattle a day, and that's just out of one plant out of five plants that they own.
Wow. So you would estimate that out of the five plants, there are about 10,000 head a day?
Yeah, pretty much. We have, my company owns its own feedlots that have over 3,000 head of cattle on it per day.
Wow.
That sounds about normal.
Yeah.
that actually is probably a little bit on the low end even. One thing that's happened since really the 1960s, when the byproducts that packers had relied on to subsidize the cost of meat, because remember, Americans don't eat the whole carcass, they only eat part of it. After World War II, and especially during the 1960s, the demand for those byproducts dropped. For example, hides from cattle weren't, there was not nearly enough as much demand for those because shoe manufacturers weren't making shoes of leather anymore. And so meatpacking plants changed at the time to eliminate every possible efficiency. The plants became much bigger, much more streamlined, much more automated. So that kind of output now would be probably toward the middle range of what a plant can put out.
Well, in the meantime, there's the cost to the consumer. As I assume that as the business becomes more efficient, then the meat becomes cheaper. But do you find that from a consumer's perspective that the consumer is more concerned about the quality of the meat or the cost of the meat?
The cost of the meat, there's no doubt. And I realize that probably flies in the face of what people expected me to say, particularly where you are. I live in Iowa, by the way. Yes, it's true that many people today want to eat organic meat. They want meat from local farms. They want free-range chickens or whatever. But those people are still a relatively small minority of the population. And one thing that I found when I researched the book was Americans historically have become very upset when the price of meat goes even a little bit beyond what they think it should be. You know, it's not like there's a firm price. There's just some sort of mental price in their heads. Meat should cost X. And when it goes above that, I found case after case where Americans staged demonstrations, trashed butcher shops, went to Washington and demanded that, by God, the government had to do something about this. So it's definitely price. But for that price, Americans also want what they regard as quality. Now, to some people, that might be an organic beef tenderloin from a farmer who lives 5 miles away. But in general, what people want is what they want. And what they want is very high-quality meats at a very low price.
Let's talk to Lauren in Janesville next. Hi, Lauren.
Hi.
What's your comment?
Oh, my comment is, I guess I'm one of those customers who cares. I have been in the past a 17-year vegetarian. I did that largely because when I learned how animals lived and were processed, it was very upsetting to me in these contained feeding lots and such. I also live in Wisconsin, so I can see, as I'm driving now, a dairy farm with, I think, 6,000 cattle that never get outside at all. They stay in these 24-hour lit pole barns, and that's it. And right in front, they have the place where they put all their manure or whatever it is with the gas, the methane gas. But I prefer also, especially with GMO feed for the cattle and the antibiotics and such, I definitely will only eat grass-fed beef and grass-finished beef for those reasons. And I have lived in other countries where there's a lot more grass-fed. You mentioned our large pasture areas in this country, which is true. And I think it's moving a lot in that direction because I have numbers of friends, and certainly my family is definitely all grass-fed. And I've noticed that milk is coming out now in the stores that said it's called grass milk. So people are beginning to understand there's differences in the nutritional value, definitely differences in the taste, differences in whether you're getting antibiotics in your system that you don't want or getting GMO products in your system you don't want.
So there's a listener there who is more concerned about the quality of the meat or the animal products than the cost.
That's right. And again, there are many people like that today, but they're still a relatively small percentage. Perhaps it will make everyone feel better if I say that, I eat very little meat. After 25 years of vegetarianism, I just don't eat a lot of meat. I eat about 25 pounds a year. The average per capita in the U.S. is, I think, 225 pounds a year, which means somebody's eating a lot of meat.
Wow.
And I eat meat that is not raised using antibiotics. I'm not wild about grass-fed meat, so I don't eat that either. But I also realize that many people don't care about that, and they don't care enough to want to spend the price point, because there is a big price difference between conventional meat and, let's call it, small-scale meat. And as long as the demand remains so high in this country, and I don't see that that's going to change anytime soon, then meat manufacturers and livestock producers are going to be stuck with the system they have. The only way to, I think anyway, the only way to really make dramatic changes in the way meat is produced in this country is if demand just plunges, and then there won't be the need for these highly hyper-efficient systems that we use now, because those systems are designed to raise, in livestock, for example, to raise a lot of livestock on very little land, because agricultural land is extremely high-priced, and to do so with very little labor, because there is almost no agricultural labor available to farmers other than themselves. And the idea that somehow we can switch to small scale and feed everyone, I think is impossible, if only because we haven't got the land for pasture. Land is simply too expensive. It's not going to happen anytime soon, not on the scale at which we eat meat now.
Is the meat industry pushing back against hormones?
Hormones are used relatively little and almost entirely in cattle production. It's antibiotics that cause more grief for everyone. I will say that the science about antibiotics, so it's called subtherapeutic antibiotic use when you feed antibiotics to animals, and the reason farmers do this is because it allows animals to reach market weight much faster, and so it reduces their production costs. There's a tremendous amount of science, but mostly there's a lot of very political science. I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to, I have no idea whether we're affecting the evolution of bacteria because of the use of antibiotics or not. Mm-hmm. I don't know, so I'm not even going to wade into that one. No, of course, farmers would prefer not to use it because they know they would prefer not to have to use it, but they also know that if that's taken away from them, and everyone in the meat industry that I have talked to has said, yes, they expect antibiotics to be banned on the farm except for used by veterinarians. We'll find out what will happen. Presumably, the price of meat will go up. If the price of meat goes up enough, the big question is, will consumers reduce their demand?
Well, Maureen, thank you so much for shedding some light on this and for posing some interesting questions for us to think about.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
That was Maureen Ogle. She's a historian and author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America.